So such a massive amount of newer music being created since the 90s has relied on samples and beats and other lifting of elements from the 60s and 70s songs, and as one of the pioneers of songwriting and arranging of at least, the era of the 70s and 80s. Could you talk a little bit about a couple of the elements that are so unique to that era that they just keep coming back over and over again in more modern material?
Well, the way I sort of evaluate it is that because we played live, right? All of our records are played live, so we start. It's a linear journey, right? We start at the beginning and we finish at the end of the song. So during the course of that journey, all sorts of one type, what we call one-time events happen, and DJs listen to those records and they go, "Oh man, listen to that part of the record. Like when you play that loop, it does this certain thing and it becomes magical." And the great thing about a loop is that if you play music as a loop, it turns into music. It's not just a phrase, it becomes music. It becomes very, very catchy and cool. And because our music, even though it's the same song, the way we play the chorus in one song at one point is not the same way we play the chorus, say, later on down that linear journey. Is that too complicated of an
Oh,
explanation?
no, not at all. No, because actually, I've talked to so many artists who have really almost keyed in a little bit on the drums. Because obviously, I guess in most cases, if not all, there's a click track, at least if you're putting down non-electronic drums. But there is still always, like, I guess on stage, the human variances that are almost imperceptible, but so many artists that I've spoken to have talked to how those variances really kind of humanize and make music both on record and in concert more organic and engaging.
Well, maybe the reason why people sample our music so much is because we don't play the click tracks. We play completely live. We just count the song off and play. There's nothing that governs our sense of groove and time other than the initial count off and the way the band gels together. You'll see it in our live show. As a matter of fact, we played a couple of years ago in London at the iTunes Festival, and someone told us, this was amazing to us, out of the 93 bands that played, the only two bands that were completely live and had no click and no Pro Tools and no secret backing tape were Chic and Elton John. Everybody else had backing tracks and clicks and stuff like that. And I was like, wow, really? So there are no new completely live bands anymore? But we play dance music and we still stay in the pocket, and it's all great, groovy, and fun. And it just sounds the way that dance music sounds to us. We play live. We've always done it that way. And it's and once again, that's probably what we were talking about earlier about the sampling, because one chorus one is different than chorus two and different than chorus three, simply because of the live factor and the execution and the improvisation that happens in the course of playing a song with us.
Well, we're also to some degree seeing a pretty strong return to or integration of analog elements into contemporary recording practices, or at least that's what I'm reading and hearing from artists of all eras. Are there any particular analog effects or other gear that you prefer to use as you're working with artists today, either coaching them on performance or in studio?
phonically, that's become the big deal again. It's like, you know, everything that we used to hear on records, now we sort of want to hear it again. The digital era has taken a lot away of those, taken a lot of those elements out of the music, and certain people have described the digital recording as producing irritants, which is interesting to me because I've listened to both sides of the argument. At the end of the day, you know, I come from the analog world, but I'm also a big digital pioneer. I've always used analog instruments. You know, we've always used analog since I play a guitar. That's analog. Mm. And I have the console, the original console from the Ed Sullivan broadcast console from Studio 54. A lot of people don't realize the reason why Studio 54, the famous disco, was called that was because it was a broadcast. It was CBS Broadcast Studios. They just kept the sign up and said Studio 54.
Wow.
Those, I have that console. I like to pretend sometimes because when people come to my house and they see the plaque on it, and they say, "Oh my God, is that the console that the Beatles went through?" And I go, "No, this was actually built a few years after that."
Oh, okay. Well, you mentioned your guitar work, and you're regarded as being part of a relatively small group of really, really huge musicians. I mean, you know, Hendrix and Clapton, as two of that kind of fraternity, who have really tapped the Fender Stratocaster as a key tool in the development of a trademark sound. At this point in your career, I have to ask you, Niall, do you think you've done more to elevate the Stratocaster, or has the Strat done more for you?
Strat's done more for me. It was the perfect marriage when I bought my Strat. Obviously, I started out as a jazz guitar player, and I didn't know a great deal about solid body guitars. That just wasn't my thing. I was into playing classical music and jazz. And my partner, my former partner, Bernard Edwards, kept telling me, you know, I had to get a Strat. You know, it had to be like Ike Turner or Jimi Hendrix. I was like, nah, I don't get it. And I just happened to buy one down in Miami Beach. We were the opening act for the Jackson 5. It was 1973, and I just tried to buy the cheapest Stratocaster I could find. So I went in and I purchased this thing, and I didn't realize that it was what would be the runt of the litter. It was this wacky Strat. It was a hardtail, which they make only one out of every 100 Strats, and it was the cheapest one in the store, and it is the most unique sounding instrument I've ever played, and I've never been able to get another one. And I think that sound, with the way that I play it, has become my signature sound.
Mm-hmm. And you've had good luck preserving it into the current era?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I don't even think about it. It's just my guitar, and I just carry it with me everywhere I go. Mm-hmm. Anytime a person sees me, they see me with it slung over my shoulder. I've been carrying it since 1973.
Okay.
And, it, you know, it's got a lot of nicks in it, and the color's changed.
Yep, yep.
But the sound that it produces is amazing, and I think that when you hear us play live, all of a sudden you start to realize how integrated that guitar sound is into our music.
That's very true, because as I was researching this over the weekend, I was drawn to the Montreux video. Mm-hmm. of you and the band, and mm-hmm. And observing that. You use such the organic Strat settings and sound.
Yeah.
Were there other artists that you were listening to at the time when you first acquired that instrument that you espoused to sound like, or did this really the sort of kind of rapid rhythmic kind of chunka style that you use? Is you know, is was that, did you just discover that one day and it stuck and it became your trademark.
Yeah, no, my partner at the time was trying to teach me, because I was so, I wouldn't say I was a snob. Yeah, I was a snob. I was a jazz snob, and I didn't want to play like that. And he says, you know, with your knowledge of harmony, if you applied that to this rhythmic concept, you'd be the only guy who can do this stuff. And I was like, what are you talking about? I could care less. And then a kid played on my amp because we were, you know, we were pretty popular when we first started, and this is before we became Chic. And so we would do shows on our own when we weren't with the Jackson 5, and we'd have an opening act. And sometimes we didn't have enough time to change equipment, so the opening act would use our gear. This young kid in Miami Beach plugged into my amp, and he sounded amazing, and he was playing a Fender Stratocaster. I went out the very next day and bought a Stratocaster.
Oh, okay.
Okay, now teach me that thing you were doing. And I went into the bathroom for a couple of weeks and came out. I emerged as the Nile Rodgers who plays the way I play now.
Okay, great.
And the thing that's cool is that, you know, when you hear our live show, which is, I guess, what this is all about, most people don't realize who composers are, right? We're totally anonymous. And the most fun of playing our live show is to watch the people's reactions when they go, oh, my God, I didn't know he wrote this. I didn't know he wrote that song, too. That's my favorite song. Mm. Even my mom does that to me. She will drive in the car somewhere, and a song will come on, and she goes, I love that song. And I look at her and I smile. I go, Mom, I wrote that song. She goes, what are you talking about? That's so-and-so. I said, yeah, but I'm still the songwriter. I wrote it with him like 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about the band we're going to see backing you on Thursday.
So Chic is basically, when Chic was created back in 1977, it was the vehicle for my compositions. So basically, I write ensemble music. Rarely do I write a composition that's to be performed by one or two people. It's usually to be performed by an ensemble, unless it's a soundtrack type of thing. But my commercial pop music is performed by a unit, and that unit is called Chic. And it's always the best musicians that I know, and that's what it is. So I've always had a great band, and since 1977 we've always been Chic, and most of the time when you hear the records that I've produced, it's my band Chic either playing the records for another artist or supplementing that artist band. So when you hear the songs, they sound, I'm not trying to come off weird or egotistical, I'm just giving you facts, that when people hear us play a lot of music that's familiar to them, they go, oh my God, that sounds really amazing. I say, yeah, because we're the ones who were playing on the record, or we're the ones who did it in the first place. It's just that, you know, when David Bowie did Let's Dance, people didn't look at the band. They didn't look at the credits on the record. They just think of David Bowie. Or when they think of Diana Ross, you know, they just think of Diana Ross. It's just a sledge. You don't think about the band, and you turn it over, and you say, oh, that band is Chic. Or you look at the Madonna, you know, Like a Virgin, and you realize, oh, that band is Chic. So when we play our set, and we do a lot of these songs that have been big in my life, they sound very much like the record because we're the people who played it in the first place.
Mm. Well, I was going to ask you, you mentioned, it's almost eerie that you mentioned two names that are in my next question, which is second to final question, and I'll let you go. Is there a difference between how someone, and maybe you hadn't worked with these individuals in a while, but I assume you still keep your eye on them, or kept your eye on them in Bowie's case. But is there a difference between how someone like a Madonna or David Bowie approached putting a record together in modern day versus somebody like a Lady Gaga or like a Pharrell Williams?
Well, the only difference is that the artists, they usually have their concept of what they're doing and the way they work. So I try and adapt to that, but it's not that different, because if I'm the producer of the record, that's what they hire me for. They hire me to make the best version of those songs that we've chosen to do. So usually it becomes more of my process. And that makes sense, right? If you're hiring a producer to make your record, you want to do what they do, because they just did what you did. Well, you could do it without them. So when I'm working with an artist like Lady Gaga, it's very much the same as if I'm working with Adam Lambert, or if I'm working with Daft Punk, or if I'm working with David Bowie, or working with Madonna or Diana Ross, or, you know, or Sister Sledge or NXS or Avicii. I mean, people don't realize that when I do a record with Avicii, we can typically write 6 songs in a day, and that process is organic and wonderful, and it feels the same thing as if I were writing 6 songs a day with David Bowie.
I got it.
It's really the same.
Good. Well, final question then. You've worked with so many younger or up-and-coming artists and arrangers and producers, and in so many cases have helped catapult them to greater fame. Can you talk about a couple of the proteges you've had whose willingness to learn from you have made you particularly proud? And obviously, I'll precede that by saying, of course, it's like choosing probably between your favorite children. But, can you talk about a couple who have really flourished under your guidance?
They would have probably flourished anyway. But I'll just say some of the great collaborations that I've had in the last few years that have been really wonderful, and the people have gone on to become superstars. So Sam Smith, I met him very early in his career when I produced this group called Disclosure. So we all got together and we wrote together and played a song together. And next thing you know, Sam then got his own solo deal at his very first record. Was a monster hit. Now he's a superstar. So I would say that that's probably the biggest example, because when I first walked into the studio, he was just an unknown guy. I was sitting there, who is this guy? I was working with Disclosure, and I said, oh, he's our friend Sam Smith. And I didn't realize that Sam was the guy who did the vocal on the Disclosure record, Latch. So once we started working together, I was like, oh, wow, cool. I didn't know that was you. And we've had a great relationship ever since. So I would say Sam Smith is probably the biggest guy who went from, just starting out to now being an international superstar.
Fantastic. Well, I took extra time. I'm so sorry. I appreciate the extra couple minutes, though, and can't wait to see you in Westport Thursday night. We'll see you in a few days, and best of luck.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
It's really a fun show, and I'd love to hear your remarks after you see the show. It's so much fun. It's ridiculous.
Excellent.
It's like I always say, we have so much fun at our live shows, it should be illegal.
Well, excellent. I well.